There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone who'll watch over me.
Author of the Week on Radio Gorgeous.
I'm in the North London home of acclaimed author Susie Boyd. She has written 6 novels and a memoir, My Julie Garden Life, which was staged at the Nottingham Playhouse and serialised on Radio 4. Today we're talking about her latest novel, Love and Fame. Hi Susie, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hello there.
So can you tell us the setting for your novel and about the characters?
Well, the book is really about the first year of a marriage between Eve, a young woman who was sort of brought up to be an actress but has had a little stumble in her first major professional role, and her husband, Jim, who is an expert on anxiety.
That makes me laugh. Sorry about the anxiety thing. I mean, it's obviously it is a serious thing, anxiety. I suffered from anxiety disorders for over 20 years, so I really know about it. As a person who came down to London from Yorkshire and having no family, I've always had a curious fascination with people who come from London. And in your book, you get a warm, fuzzy feeling from all the domestic scenes and conversations in your book. These people belong in London and were raised in London, and it all feels so natural. Can you tell us if that was intentional?
I'm really glad to hear you say that. I have, in other books, had London almost being a character, but I think it just came very naturally in this one. I suppose all the characters do love London. Quite often in this book, when people are at a loss, they seem to go for a walk and talk, find things in their environment that possibly reflects what's going on inside themselves. So I suppose, yes, I definitely must have intended that, but it just came sort of very naturally. I've lived in London all my life and I do love it and I'm very, very proud of it. And if people do it down, it hurts my feelings. And so I suppose it did seem a sort of powerful setting from all the characters. Everyone is from London and I think appreciates it as a sort of setting for them.
Now, you're from North London, and it was a bit like, what was the security of having a mother and a home in London? Does it make London more casual for you and more relaxed about it? Or can you keep up the ambition, you know what I mean, about...
Yeah. I'm not sure. Sometimes I meet people and they say, oh, I could never live in London, and they live in the country or in a small town elsewhere. And I sometimes think, what if I and all the people I know also couldn't live in London, and we'd be miles stronger and happier and feel more resourceful if we lived somewhere else. But I think it is somewhere I've always loved, and I think I would never feel that I sort of own the city in any way, but I'm constantly surprised by it. I often think if I live somewhere else, there's nowhere I'd rather come on holiday, and I sometimes imagine coming on holiday here from somewhere else, and then I think, but where would the other place be? And then I get in a muddle, but it is somewhere I've always loved.
Now, you said something interesting, because I said, oh, your house, it's on this lovely quiet street, it's lovely and quiet. And you said, actually, you miss traffic, you miss the urbanness, you find this area a little bit too quiet.
Yeah, I do like a dual carriageway and 7 bus routes going past and even dog ends and litter and someone asking me for money on the corner that I can give money to. And I just feel, I think if you are going to live in London, you want to be sort of right at the heart of it. And I have a fantasy in old age of sort of retiring to a very small room in Piccadilly and be visited by my grandchildren and plying them with sweets and maybe even cigarettes and alcohol and building up a bit of a reputation for myself.
Maybe you could live in a hotel. That's always been a fantasy of mine. You could be like the old lady up at the top floor, you know?
Yeah, like Elaine Stritch living at the Carlisle or something. Yes, I will say a big yes to that kind offer. Thank you.
So I must talk about the dialogue in the book. It's so witty, so sharp, so brilliant. You're not going to read out some dialogue, but you're going to read out some sort of train of thought from the beginning of the book. Do you want to have a go?
So the book opens with a sort of stream of consciousness. The main character, Eve, it's partly her thoughts, partly little snippets of advice she's been given or things she's heard or stuff she's picked up on the internet. And she's sort of, she's packing for her honeymoon, and she's very aware of all the sort of sex scandals in the newspapers and having a sense of women not being treated perhaps quite as they should be, plus having just bought a nightie from a department store that the saleswoman says will make her look like a goddess, and she's trying to sort of process all these things. How could you have a honeymoon and the way you felt things no one had ever felt before? Was that too much to hope? Was it a bit idiotic being in love and getting married? And all these thoughts are sort of coming to her as she puts all her bits and bobs in her suitcase, feeling that she, that she's sort of very lucky, but she feels nervous and a little bit afraid and excited. But this should be the happiest time of your... Just let yourself... Loads of people would die to... You should be... Drain out every last drop. It's a once in a lifetime. Well, let's hope. Oh. Well, sure, of course, these things can be a bit. In fact, famously so. So just work on trying to maybe... Keep busy and don't give yourself a second to... Of course, there's so much pressure to feel as though everything's... And it's really important to allow yourself. Now and then, anyway. Look away when you... Have you tried tranquility? Avoiding caffeine, sugar and alcohol could really make a... Gluten's a pig. Don't watch the news every night, might be a... Make an effort to enjoy things while... Loads of people don't know what's going on in the world and they're completely... Just a thought, until you feel a bit more... Early nights, think of yourself as an athlete in preparation, a princess, a thoroughbred, a nun about to take... Maybe not that. Oh yes, and definitely log out of anything that could... St. John's wort is meant to be very... Oh dear, that doesn't sound... There's a brilliant woman off Devonshire Place. She's quite scary, but you just lie down in this squishy leather throne and she somehow disengage. But you look well on it.
So she is anxious because she's setting up for a honeymoon. Yeah.
She is, and she's possibly getting married on the rebound. She doesn't quite realise it at the start of the book. But almost fresh out of drama school, she got an enormous part in a play in the West End, which was sort of everyone's dream come true. But she got such bad stage fright that she had to drop out of the play. And the life that she had imagined for herself isn't quite going to happen, or it's not going to happen yet. And although she felt it was possibly unfair that she had such a great chance, having sort of messed it up has sort of given her a small sort of crisis and made her think that a lot of the things she's assumed about her life possibly aren't going to be true. So that's another aspect that makes her married state a bit more fraught.
Yeah, that's quite a large strand. And there's a line that I really, really stuck out at me when I was reading your book. And that is, Mum says disappointment and relief can be the same thing or are the same thing.
Yeah, that is something I've noticed a bit in life, that often if you want something very, very much, it not happening doesn't feel like the end of the world when you think it might. And similarly, this to me in my mind relates to mine, and in fact one of my sisters shares with me, a sort of absolute love of a cancellation. Even if I'm slightly longing for something, if it gets cancelled, I often have a very nice feeling. And I think that, I've always thought disappointment and relief were a bit... especially if, I suppose, because if something means the world to you, the potential for it not quite living up to your expectations is so huge that if it's taken away, there can be, a huge feeling of relief. I sometimes think of that thing I think that Homer Simpson says, which is something like, if you don't try, you sure can't fail.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the key kind of underlining threads to this book, wouldn't you agree? I mean, it is, she's getting to grips with her whole... Anyway, we can't go into it too far.
I know, I'm trying not to give too much away.
I know. So the sweet poor Jim in the book, and he has such patience getting married to a woman who suffers from severe doubt, and she comes from a tight theatrical family. Do you think he really knows what he's letting himself in for?
Well, it's hard. I mean, trying not to give too much away, there's a lot of mourning and grief in this book. And although Jim could be, Jim, who's sort of Eve's short-lived, long-suffering husband, does seem to be almost too passive at times, I was trying to think of him as an almost ideal person to be on the receiving end of someone who has experienced extreme grief. And I think grief can make us very, very exacting. It can sort of make monsters out of us. But at the same time, all grieving people really want is people to give them the benefit of the doubt, give them a bit of extra fuss, just take the sort of difficult nature of their wants and needs in their stride for a bit. And I often think in Victorian times, people used to wear a black armband just to say to the world, can you be just a little bit careful to me for a while? And I think that's what Jim's doing. And although possibly Eve does want him to say hello enough, and he does it, he does towards the end of the book, and it is shocking to both of them. I felt that although he is very kind, he's also very, very strong, and you feel he's completely able to be himself and carry on in his own world, and he is very grown up and sort of mature in a lot of ways. So I wanted to see him hit, I wanted his kindness to seem a sort of strength rather than him in any way being a victim of her reasonably violently mood swings.
So can we now go on to the sisters, Beach and Rebecca? They're extraordinarily close. Are you as close to one of your sisters as that?
I am very close to my sisters. I've got lots, which means that if you have a slightly difficult time with one, there's always another one around the corner. But we do talk all the time. And I've got a huge family. In fact, almost every weekend it's someone's birthday. So we are really close-knit family, and I value that hugely. And sisters are, it is wonderful having lots of sisters, and I often turn to them for advice and consolation.
Lovely. And Beach is a bereavement counsellor like you. Did you get the idea of your story through your work? And can you tell us about being a counsellor?
Well, it's not something I've done for quite a long time, but I did it for sort of 10 years, stopping about 8 years ago, because I had, during that time, I lost both my parents and I didn't quite feel up to it, although I might be going back again soon.
So that's interesting. When you lost them, you couldn't do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So why did you do it in the first place then?
I had a big bereavement when I was 20, and I just felt closer and more comfortable around the subject than most people of my age did. If you have a big bereavement when you're 20, I think bereaved people often divide the world into those who are grieving and those who aren't, and those who aren't grieving don't seem completely real or almost to have any point to them. And when you're 20, almost none of your contemporaries are grieving. It's a very odd space to occupy. And I had a brilliant bereavement counsellor myself who used to come round to my flat once a week at 6:30 on Mondays, and we just talked and talked and talked. And what's so valuable about the work, I feel, is that people just aren't really allowed to grieve now. I know people who have a major bereavement on a Friday, and at work someone's telling them off on a Tuesday for getting something wrong. And I feel it takes so much courage and planning and maybe time and even money to just be able to hold life at bay for a while and have the feelings you need to feel. And I think it's a little bit like having a newborn baby. I think you need to sit and hold the loved one close to you for as long as you can and keep every other aspect of life out for as long as you can, if you're able to. And I know it's not possible for lots of people and difficult for almost everyone. So I suppose I have got a sort of agenda that there's a massive sort of flood of unspent grief around that. And I think that in the past, a nice woman from the church or the synagogue would come and sit with you once a week till you felt stronger. And no one really lives like that anymore. And so I think people are so worried. Everyone says, you know, no one likes a misery and that kind of thing. But I think these feelings really, really need to come out. And so that's why I did the work I did for Cruise Bereavement Care, which is a voluntary charity that gives its services for free. And you go to the person's house and just for as long as they want. And so I suppose in the book, Beatrice Beach works with children, which isn't something I ever did, but I was interested in that kind of work. And obviously with children, grief can't be dealt with so directly. It's done more on the slant. So there's lots of play and games. And in the book, people make a scrapbook sort of around the subject of their child's life. And there may be gradually the lost person will come in and that sort of thing. So it's a possibly a more subtle and complex job of work when children are involved, but I was interested in that too.
Because I was with someone last night and his wife died in February, and he's got a son who's 16, and he said, I'm worried about him, because he doesn't seem to have even cried yet. He cried on the night she died, but that's it. And he's worried that he's not grieving. He's at boarding school and he's doing his GCSEs and everything. I mean, how can you kind of encourage your child to grieve?
It's so hard to know, and I think often children feel tremendous pressure, or people think as long as they've got a string of A stars then they must be fine, or sometimes
that's what he got.
Yeah, and sometimes the measure of, I mean, in my experience as a bereavement counsellor, I felt that often the people who did best were the people who fell apart for a bit, rather than the people who felt we must keep the show on the road, we've got to keep all our standards up, we've got to do exactly everything we always did and exactly the way we always did it, or something so terrible will happen, we'll all be swallowed up. And it seemed to me that people, that the things you do to avoid grief often make you feel worse than the grief itself. So examples of those might be, you know, getting obsessed with a very unsuitable partner, or alcohol, drugs, too many biscuits, whatever. I felt that there is a real, almost a stigma against grieving. And I think it's to do with productivity. There's an idea that anything that inhibits productivity must be bad and must be dangerous. And if we stop doing something now, we'll never take it up again. If we start crying, we won't be able to stop ourselves. All those sorts of things. And
also, it's a thing about letting go. You're in society now, you, as you say, you've got to be proactive all the time. You've got to be rushing around. You've got to be doing something. So you're saying if you let go and let, which is what we're, the opposite of what we kind of feel we should do, and let ourselves slump. That's what you're saying, isn't it? Let yourself.
I do. I'm also aware that it's different for everyone, and for some people that might not be the best thing. But in my experience, it feels like, I mean, the most common advice is to keep busy. And in my experience of keeping busy, all the things I did, I then had to do again because I did them wrong. Telling people to keep busy makes me think of the sort of very old-fashioned advice, if you had a nosebleed, to sort of tip your head back, which works for about 2 minutes till your mouth fills with blood. I mean, I just feel that there's not enough kindness in the advice to keep busy. And sure, if people want to do that and find that comforting, then that's obviously the right thing for them. But I think quite a lot of the advice to grieving people, it feels, is designed to protect the people who might have to support them rather than what's best for the person.
And what about that thing about grieving stages? Do you believe in that? You know, there's meant to be a thing, I don't know what it is, but anger and, you know, all these different stages.
I think grieving just certainly isn't in any way linear. So I think although those stages of anger, denial, bargaining, all those acceptance, those sorts of things, I think that they just, you might have all of them in one day or none of them in one day. I think that there isn't a kind of general order to it particularly. I think in order to stop grieving acutely, there's got to be something sort of better on offer. And I think that not holding the loved one very, very close to you often feels like another loss, and that it's fine to keep doing that for as long as you want to need to, even if people do think it's strange. In the book, someone makes a joke about a woman in Ireland who has a cardboard cut out of her husband made and laminated and takes him to parties, and everyone just thinks a bit weird, but as if it's okay with her, then fine. And I just think there's lots and lots of different ways to do these things, and that we all have to grieve in our own characters. And if you are someone who is very big on taking seriously what's happened to you, then it's going to be a very long, lengthy, complicated process, and you know, people should almost feel proud of that if that's the choice that they want to make.
The book makes you think about parents dying. By the way, I'm making this book sound quite grim, and it's not. It's very witty, it's very sparky, and it's very lively. So please don't, just because we're going to be sad subjects, but we've got to talk around the story, you see, which is difficult. So it has got black humour in it, hasn't it? It's got.
I mean, it is a comedy. I did, in fact, when I was feeling a bit glum, my husband said, why don't you write a comedy to cheer yourself up? And I thought, okay. And so it is, some people, I mean, it has got sad bits in it, but some people do find it very, 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 very funny. It's got lots of sort of slightly slapstick set pieces in it. And because the Eve, the main character, her father was an actor in a sitcom, there are lots of jokes it's a sort of book where people sit down and tell other people jokes, and it's some conventions of sitcoms are borrowed to, and there's also a sort of very farcical scene with two sisters in the hotel, and one of them having a sort of dodgy guy. She's in the bathroom and he's in the bedroom, and she's got to somehow escape without hurting his feelings or creating any kind of a stir. And there are very farcical moments in it. And I wanted to have, there's quite a lot of time in the book with people sort of sitting around chatting and saying, having arguments over ridiculous things. And quite often when people have arguments, they end up really, really, really laughing. And there's one bit where, with the two sisters, one of them is so dependent on the other that the other one, although she loves it, can hardly stand it. And they have a silly argument about where one of them says to the other, "You've just got to stop making me miserable." And she says, "I've never made anyone miserable in my life. I wouldn't know how." And the other one says, "Well, take some fucking lessons." And then they both look at each other as if to say, "What?" And then they just start laughing, and they both feel relieved that this isn't going to be the big argument of their lives. Not this time, but maybe next time.
Fantastic. And Love and Fame is out today, and it's published by Virago. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much.
Somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone who'll watch over me.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2017. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.